Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Thursday, June 20, 2019. We're getting some much-needed rain today, a slow and steady soaking rain, a good day for indoor chores. It's been a few weeks since we last posted a podcast. Beth and I have been doing some traveling. Yesterday, I had the good fortune to sit down with Mike Butler, the Executive Director of the Tennessee Wildlife Federation. This is Mike's second visit as a guest on this program. Some of you will recall our wide-ranging interview from July 2018. In today's program, Mike and I discuss the problem which fishery managers are having with certain species of Asian carp, which have invaded our waterways. I suspect many of my listeners will be unaware that this is even an issue, but let me assure you, this is a huge problem. For those of you who have access to a computer, do a YouTube search for jumping invasive carp. What you see in these video clips is real, and it is happening in Tennessee. Not only are these fish becoming a safety hazard, but they are having a devastating effect on the ecological balance of our Tennessee waterways. Moreover, recreational boating and fishing are important for their contribution that they make to our economy. It is already being observed that the Asian carp problem is having a negative effect on this part of the economy. And so, I talk with Mike today about the origins of the problem and the solutions which are being suggested. And so I hope you'll enjoy this interview with Mike Butler. Mike Butler, welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. It's good to be back.
Mike, you are the very first person to have a second episode of the Mark Fraley Podcast. So I'm thrilled to have you back on the show. And for my listeners, we did a program about a year or so ago.
Was that long?
And it was just about wildlife in general and the Wildlife Federation, which you are the head of. The Executive Director of Tennessee Wildlife Federation. So I would point my listeners to that previous show if you wanted to learn more about Mike. Usually in these shows, we do a little biographical talk at the beginning about the person's background and all that. But we're going to skip through that today because we did that on the previous show. So, Mike, I wanted to get with you today because there's been some news reporting and certainly a lot of discussion about the issue of invasive carp in Tennessee. We have focused in the past on this show about invasive plants and honeysuckle bushes and kudzu and that sort of thing. We've never talked about the aquatic nuisances that are out there. What can you tell us about the invasive carp?
Well, it's not just one species.
Okay.
It's actually three different species, maybe four if you count grass carp. There's silver carp, which jump out of the water. They're the ones that are sensitive to sound in the water, like motorboat sounds.
Right.
There is the big head carp, which does not jump, but it grows bigger than the silver. The silver can get large, 30 to 60 pounds in that range.
Okay.
From what I understand, but the big head carp can get much larger. I think there was one caught two weekends ago on Cumberland River that weighed 104, 108 pounds.
My goodness.
So they get to be sizable. There is the grass carp, which some people are familiar with. You can buy what are called triploid grass carp, which basically cannot reproduce. They've been modified so they cannot reproduce, and they're used to control weeds and aquatic weeds in ponds and lakes that are landlocked. And then there's another species called the black carp, which is not as common but just as destructive. It feeds on mussels and snails, and frankly, Tennessee has some of the most important mussel areas for freshwater mussels in the world.
Right.
We have the greatest diversity of freshwater mussels that exists anywhere on the planet.
Right.
So we're concerned about the impacts that those fish could have on our native mussel populations.
But, so there's
those four species, we're really concerned about those those three. Grass carp, not so much right now.
Are there native carps?
Yes, they're native carps. Okay. But they don't have nearly the proclivity to destroy the entire ecosystem, the food chain. I mean, the problem with carp is they eat plankton. They eat zooplankton.
Okay.
They feed in the top 3 feet of the water column, and they reproduce at an astonishing rate. They can reproduce. They require moving water to reproduce, but when they do reproduce and find favorable conditions, they can spawn several times a year. And then what happens is those fish eat up all the food, the plankton food source for our native bait fish like threadfin shad and gizzard shad, which are a staple of our game fish, like okay. crappie and largemouth bass and smallmouth bass and things like
right.
that. So they due to their aggressive growth nature and just the sheer numbers that they end up producing, they can take up an enormous volume of the available habitat. So in places along the Illinois River, you have instances where they've measured them and found that 90% of all the fish biomass in that part of the river was carp.
Wow.
So they displace other native fish as well as compete for food resources with
right.
them.
What do we know about how they got into the streams in Tennessee?
Aquaculture facilities, arguably in Arkansas, back in the 70s,
okay.
were flooded by the Mississippi River, and they escaped, got into the Mississippi, and then they've been slowly making their way up the Mississippi, down the Mississippi, up the Missouri, up the Ohio, into the Tennessee, into okay. the Cumberland River systems.
Okay. So how far up the river do we know, up the Tennessee and Cumberland?
Well, the Wildlife Agency, I think, has any dam that has a lock on it, they can pass through the lock.
Okay, I wondered
so
about that.
I think they're as far as I think the agency has found indications of silver carp as far as Pickwick, Wheeler, maybe in that area, Wilson Reservoir in northern Alabama.
Okay.
I don't know if we know exactly the point, but I know that they're in Pickwick.
Okay.
And they may be further upstream than that, but they do not appear to be in Gunnersville for silver carp or okay. north or upstream.
In Kentucky
of that.
Lake?
They're in Kentucky Lake
okay.
by the thousands,
okay.
tens
okay.
of thousands.
Okay.
You also have the bighead carp, which I think the Wildlife Agency has a test. You can actually use something called an eDNA test to test water samples to look for DNA of carp, and they've had a positive hit on bighead carp as far upriver as Chickamauga. So the goal is, with our efforts, and we'll talk about this
yeah,
more, is
yeah.
to try to make sure that we prevent these fish from getting into Gunnersville in any meaningful number and upstream of that, so that we can protect the fisheries in Gunnersville, Nickajack, and of course Chickamauga,
right.
which is one of the top three bass fishing lakes in the United
right.
States right,
right.
now.
Right.
So on the Cumberland River, I think they're up to Old Hickory Reservoir. You know, they cannot get into Percy Priest because of
that
the physical.
Doesn't have a
it
lock.
Doesn't have a
yeah,
lock. It's
right.
got the physical dam right there on I-40. When you pass through town, you can see
right.
it. But there are also other ways that these fish can get transported around that I would mention to you. One is people used cast nets to catch bait fish for cut bait for catfish and other things. And it is illegal to move, I think, live bait fish now in a bunch of Tennessee reservoirs. I don't have the specific reservoirs committed to memory.
Okay.
But I know the commission passed a recent rule that says you shouldn't move. You know, if you go into waters that have Asian carp and you use a cast net, you could be catching young Asian carp. And then what happens is you put them in your bucket and you take them to go fish a different water. You dump them out. You're translocating these fish. They get established.
Right.
So what you want to make sure you do is you don't move any bait fish from the source of water that you caught them in.
Right.
Number one. Number two, make sure you clean all of your equipment off and make sure you dump all of your ballast water, if you have ballast
right.
water, or your live well water
right.
in an area that doesn't move any potential fish eggs or even invasive exotic aquatic weeds with them.
Right.
So
right.
trying to keep things clean, trying to keep things cleaned out, keep them where you found them, that's really important to helping to prevent the movement of these fish into areas like Percy Priest, right. which, you know, by nature should not be able to get these fish. I mean, we do know that birds can carry some of the eggs on their legs, like herons and things like that. Mm-hmm. But we think that the bigger threat and the bigger vector for that stuff is coming from people moving boats from one water to the other water and needing to pay more attention to what's going on when they're taking things from one reservoir to another.
Right. So, Mike, you know, this sounds like almost an insurmountable problem in terms of eradication of these fish or doing something really meaningful to control their populations. Are there really any plans to do that? Or?
There are, and really it is you will never get rid of these fish. Okay. It's kind of like chronic wasting disease. Now that we have it, we'll never get rid of it, but we can manage it.
Okay.
And there is a particular technique that we call block and tackle, taking a sports analogy, I guess.
All right.
So the idea is you put up barriers on the locks. In Illinois, I believe they've used electric barriers. We are testing, the coalition that we're part of, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has put an acoustic barrier, a sound barrier on Barkley Dam that should be turned on in the next month or so.
Okay.
These fish are sensitive. They have extra bones in their ears, and they're sensitive to sounds underwater, which is why they get irritated and jump in the first place. And so you can use that against them to keep them from going near areas that we don't want them to go. And so one of the things that has been tried in smaller scale and tried in a laboratory setting and has proven to work is this what is called a bioacoustical fish fence. And basically it's a bunch of speakers underwater with a bubble screen that is placed at the lock to prevent the fish from getting into the lock.
Okay.
And so we're going to be testing that with some GPS marked fish. Some carp that they catch. The agency's going to be monitoring that with the Fish and Wildlife Service to see, you know, how effective is this? How can they tweak it to be highly effective? So that's the blocking part.
Okay.
If necessary, you could add an electrical-type fence, but those have a lot of challenges around them, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. Putting electricity into water when you've got boats coming by can be a challenge.
Sure.
So the other side of this is the tackle part, and that's a play on words. Okay. You want to use commercial fishing and commercial fishermen's efforts and their tackle, fishing tackle, to catch as many fish as you can and get them out of the water.
Right.
So the challenge there is making sure that there's an incentive for those commercial fishermen to want to catch those fish, and that's primarily, since they're in the business to catch fish to sell them, that's a financial incentive.
Right.
So what we have been doing is supporting efforts to secure funding so that the Wildlife Agency has a program they've developed called the Asian Carp Harvest Incentive Program, or ACHIP, where they're buying nets and equipment for certain commercial fishermen, and they are incentivizing the price point through the buyers of fish to increase the price point per pound.
Okay.
What that does is create that financial incentive. And so that program has been underway for a handful of months now, and they're catching several hundred thousand pounds of Asian carp.
My goodness. And what do they do with these fish once they catch them?
Well, the markets appear to be there. The trick is getting the fish from the water to the processing facility. And we have a processing facility in Wickliffe, Kentucky.
Okay.
But Asian carp break down quickly when you take them out of the water, so you have to get them on ice very quickly.
Okay.
So we've been very supportive and instrumental in finding the money to make sure they had a flake ice machine, for example, at Paris Landing.
Okay.
So they can get these fish on ice very quickly. You know, so if you can get them out of the water and get them to market, get them to the processor, then they end up shipping several containers a week from Wycliffe all over the world, primarily to Southeast Asia and some other places. But they also have markets in the United States for cut bait.
For human consumption.
Well, human consumption is the highest price point, so that's where the focus tends to be.
And
fried Asian carp is pretty good. I've actually had it several times, and it's a light white flaky fish, and it's based on eating plant material, so it's a healthy fish. And the challenge is you've got the human market, you've got the fertilizer market, you've got the pet food market, you've got cut bait markets for lobsters, potentially in off the northeast coast.
Now what?
Yeah.
Tell me about
crabs and lobsters. I mean, they use different fish. They use cut bait or whole fish for different fish in that market to catch crabs and lobsters in their traps. They think carp can be used in that capacity.
And not a problem if it's they're in, if that's being done in salt water because the fish wouldn't tolerate the salt.
Not only that, they're dead when
they're
they use them.
Right.
I mean, they put them in there. They're already dead. Right. So those are the markets seem to be there. The trick is getting the fish out of the water. So if you block their entry point, if we cut off their access from the Ohio River at Kentucky Dam at the lock, and we cut it off at Pickwick, then you could apply a lot of pressure through commercial fishing. And there's several examples of where people have done this.
Right.
You can manage
areas.
The number down,
right.
And then you see a corresponding solid response in threadfin and gizzard shad and the plankton volumes. So you're maintaining that food, that trophic structure on food. And that's really important because if you start to unravel that food chain, then you start to really impact game fish. And we do believe, just from fishermen reports and some agency reports out of Kentucky and their wildlife department, Fish and Wildlife Department, that crappie have been negatively impacted in a pretty real way on Kentucky Lake.
By the prevalence of the
carp.
Right.
And so we've got a window of time, we think, to really get aggressive with these fish. And so the real need right now is funding, and significant funding from a federal level, because this is a federal issue. They're fighting like crazy to keep these fish out of the Great Lakes.
Right.
You've got the Illinois River chock full, the Missouri River getting full, our Tennessee River starting to see impacts, Cumberland River seeing impacts. And so we have been working very hard with Congressman David Kustoff's office and Senator Lamar Alexander's office in leading a coalition of multiple states, their state agencies and federal agencies, around nailing down funding to fund the block and tackle approach, as well as a little bit of money to make sure that we're monitoring the situation so we know that what we're doing is actually working.
So this would be federal money that would be made available to the states to implement, or is it a...
We think it would go to about three different places. You'd want the Fish and Wildlife Service, potentially the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey, to be the leads on evaluating with some of the state wildlife agencies if your techniques are working, so you can be accountable for the money you're spending. Then you want to give state block grants to the agencies, because Kentucky and Tennessee already have these programs in place. It's just put more money into it and just grow it.
Right.
Right. And then the last one, the dams, the fences, the acoustic fences, the sound barriers on the dams have to go through the Corps of Engineers. And that's a whole different ball of wax, whole different approach, whole different set of issues. It's not fast. To say the least.
Is the Corps on board with this?
We believe so, but we really need to see the infusion of money to force the hand of the Corps to make sure that we get stuff done. Right. We can't delay a lot. We can't get caught up in red tape. We've got to execute at a pretty quick pace because these fish, the good thing about these fish from what some of the researchers are telling us is that if you really put pressure on them in a commercial fishing sense, where they are, where you find them in good numbers, then you essentially keep them from moving away and going to look for new areas to occupy.
I got it.
So it's a tandem thing. You got to put the pressure on. You got to keep it on long term with commercial fishing efforts, while at the same time you're looking to block their access to new water or prevent them from repopulating areas where you're already commercially fishing them down.
It's a fascinating subject. For listeners that are curious or interested about this, I did this morning, went on to YouTube and watched a couple videos of the jumping carp fish, and just the numbers that appear in these videos are out, it's outlandish how many of those fish will appear in an area and make themselves known by their jumping.
You get into one shallow cove and and get in the middle of them, you won't want to do that again. I mean, you think about this.
It's a safety problem.
That's the big. So
yeah.
We can talk a little bit about the impact. I mentioned the impact of the native fishing. Well, if you're from Tennessee or you live in Tennessee or you grew up in Tennessee, one of the big things we do here is spend our summers on the lakes and on our reservoirs.
Right.
And we do that for skiing and jet skiing and boating. Well, imagine getting hit by a 30, 40-pound fish while you're going on a jet ski at 35 miles an hour.
Right.
It's a serious human risk issue. And we've seen and heard of impacts even beyond just recreational boating already starting to impact the price of properties on the lake at Kentucky Lake, like lake houses, lake homes.
Right.
Hard time selling them, hard time listing them, getting interest to buy them. I've actually had two or three people personally tell me that they were looking for places to buy there and decided against it because of the fish, because of the Asian carp. So
you get out on a ski-doo and motor around a little bit.
It changes the equation from being talking about the impact of fishing, which is in the billions of dollars in Tennessee, any estimates range from 2 to 3 billion annually in terms of economic impact, into tens of billions of dollars. Because if you look at our state, the Tennessee River runs through it twice, and there is an enormous amount of private value in property and homes from Kentucky Lake all the way to Knoxville.
Sure.
In those areas. And these fish can reach anywhere where there is a lock.
Wow.
And the amount of investment on these reservoirs around the state is in the tens of billions, dollars. And so I remember seeing a photograph one time of a marina in Illinois on the Illinois River that was listed. I want to say it was for either $3 or $4, maybe $5 million, and they can't sell it now for $600,000. So when you start looking at those impacts and you look at the scale of which this is happening on the Mississippi River drainage. And if you think about it, the Mississippi River drains everything from the Appalachians all the way to the Rockies.
Sure.
So if a fish can get through a lock, these carp can get there.
Right.
So we're talking to friends in North Dakota that are starting to hear about it. Missouri. There is a big project called the Brandon Road Project up in the Great Lakes area where they need roughly $1 billion. But here's the point. The longer we wait to fund the solution, the more expensive it becomes.
Sure enough.
Because the harder it's going to be
and
the more effort you're going to have to put forward.
So, Mike, the person that's listening to this this podcast now that's had their interest, has become interested in this, where would they write, which councilman or congressman or senator would they write to? To express their interest or support for this program?
Well, I would think you would want to call your local congressman. We've had support from Congressman Cooper here in Nashville. It's a bipartisan issue.
Sure.
We have had support from Congressman Cohen in Memphis. Obviously, Congressman Kustoff is our champion and leader on this topic, and those two have been working with him. We've had support from pretty much every member of Congress in the state of Tennessee and surrounding states to try to get something done. It still hasn't produced a result. As of this morning, we had an amendment to the appropriations bill in the House, in Congress, and the Rules Committee, and whatever shenanigans they're playing with, prevented any amendments from being heard. So we had a bipartisan amendment that had plenty of votes to pass the floor of the House to bring that money to start that effort. And the Rules Committee messed it up.
Goodness.
And playing politics. So, it's incredibly frustrating because these folks don't seem to be paying attention to what's going on back home or don't really care, but there's millions of dollars at stake.
Right.
And the level of anger that's going to come up over this is going to really catch some people by surprise, I think, if they're not paying attention. Now, the good news is we have strong support from Senator Alexander, and we have strong support from Senator Shelby, who is chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. We also have strong support from Leader McConnell from Kentucky.
Right.
He has made public comments in the last 3 weeks that this is the number one issue for him in Western Kentucky.
Interesting.
So we think that there's a chance. Our original ask is for $25 million to get started. And we think there's a good chance that we could get that in the Senate appropriations, and then they would go to conference committee and work out some type of compromise. But I would encourage people to let their voice be heard, contact their congressman. Usually you can go to our website and find out who that is. You can go to tnwf.org, TN for Tennessee, WF for Wildlife Federation. And we have a policy page that has a particular piece of software that allows you to find your congressman. We also think that this is important, obviously, to the state. The General Assembly has passed a resolution on the topic, raising their concerns. A couple of years ago, they also passed legislation that created a task force study committee, which led to that first round of funding that provided the ice flake machine and some of the equipment to fishermen.
Okay. For the marketing of the fish, sure.
We had some members of our state house and Senate really support that. We think there's more that they can do, and we're hearing that there's more that they want to do. So we'll be working at the state level as well, frankly, because we don't know if we can rely on Congress to act. So, you know, it's going to take us all doing it, but maybe we buy ourselves some time with state effort.
I hope that this program will increase awareness at least a little bit among my listeners about this issue. Mike, you know, it's hard to leave a topic like this without trying to find the lesson here about invasive or other alien species and bringing them in. Mm-hmm. Thoughts about that?
The longer I'm in this business, the clearer that it becomes to me that when we try to improve upon nature's design, we tend to mess things up. Now, hear me clearly say, I think we can help manage that design, and
right.
I think we can utilize and be part of the system and benefit from the design.
Right.
But when you start bringing in species that were not originally found here, if you start doing things like thinking you can engineer a river better than Mother Nature did, then you end up getting in big problems. And it ends up usually costing taxpayers billions and billions of dollars to fix it.
Yep.
And so the take-home message would be, we got to be smarter. We got to be smarter. And I think we can be. And I think you see that in a lot of different types of approaches that people are taking today. I think you can find great examples of where we as people, and especially in this country, have recovered a lot of wildlife species by being smarter and going back and learning and managing within that design rather than trying to rewrite it, so to speak.
That's a good message, Mike. Thank you so much, and appreciate you spending your time with us today.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
All right.
Anytime.